In terms of the Rich Lowry call to smash the white supremacist movement the way the FBI smashed the KKK back in the 50s and 60s, how do you do that?
Well, quite frankly, I mean, that was before my time in the FBI, but in my time in the FBI, starting in the late 1980s, certainly through the 90s and early 2000s, while the KKK wasn't very strong back at that point in time, we certainly had other white militia groups and around the country that we did our best through under the domestic terrorism auspices to work, go undercover, and in fact make many, many arrests. They were killing people. They killed a Jewish radio talk show host in the Midwest.
In Denver.
Yes.
Yeah,
and they killed bank robberies and armored car robberies. People were killed, and the FBI did a great job in breaking those down. I actually met one of the agents. He's now retired, but he actually went undercover with some of these folks for a year or two, and there was a wealth of information he got out of them. So the FBI has been working these types of cases for years and years and years, and they've never relented. Certainly, 9/11 came along. And the focus under Director Mueller, rightly or perhaps a little wrongly, went fully to the jihadists and the Islamicists among us who would do us damage here as well as internationally. And some of the focus was lost for these nationalistic militia-type groups, Aryan Nation, Posse Comitatus, and groups like that. But they've never been put completely to the wayside and forgotten about. Now we're hearing more and more about it. I'm not truly sure. I mean, I'm out of the Bureau now. I'm looking at research, and I try to do all the reading I can. I'm not sure truly how organized some of these groups are or what their numbers are at this point. I don't think it's necessarily into the thousands upon thousands. It may be, you know, maybe a few hundred of the diehards, the true believers, as we like to say. You know, their book back in the day was The Turner Diaries by actually a medical doctor, William Luther Pierce. And that was the big book that everyone subscribed to in the militia movements back then. Nowadays, and even this guy in his manifesto from El Paso referred to The Great Replacement from a French author as sort of the credo or the gospel that they're going by now. So there's always some sort of you know, external stimuli to get certain people riled up, and I assure you the FBI is on top of this in every way they can be, maybe even more so now later, hopefully, with some of the revelations of the last week or so, to be completely honest here.
Oh, well, let's hope so. The difference, one of the things that I was talking about right before you came on the air, was one of the key differences between the jihadist violence that continues to menace Western civilization and this real danger of white supremacism, is the jihadist violence has been, not so much anymore, but it has been supported lavishly by governments and by big corporate institutions and lots of money behind it and real international connections and resources. That hasn't so much been the case with white supremacists, has it? That it's been in that way organized into a functioning international operation with lavish funding?
No, it hasn't, and it's no secret that some of the Middle Eastern countries pay a good bit of money every year, a tithe or whatever you want to call it, not officially, of course, but into some of these madrasas and the various schools and the groups over there. And basically, it's almost like, you know, reverse extortion. Hey, we'll donate this money to you. Don't attack us in our countries here. And we all know the Saudi Arabian government, the 9/11 attackers, the vast majority, were Saudis, and they had been supporting some of these groups. Now, I'm not blaming the Saudis for the 9/11 attacks, but certainly there was some financial assistance there along the way. And to go back to your initial premise here, no, we don't see that in any way, shape, or form, corporate level or certainly international level, as far as I am aware, in terms of any kind of large-scale funding for any type of these activities. Because quite frankly, any attack we've seen so far, even in other countries like New Zealand and other parts of the U.S., of course, they've been relatively low cost. a weapon, a long rifle of sorts, and then, you know, a few boxes of ammo, maybe some equipment to go with it, and they're good to go, all of that for under $1,000, which probably isn't too hard today for people to raise if they need it. Fortunately, we haven't seen the large-scale sort of attacks involving airliner training or flight training like we had on 9/11 and or anything close to that. And I don't think we will, quite frankly, Michael. I just don't think that this movement, I believe it's more isolated, the more lone wolf. And actually, I don't really subscribe to the term lone wolf because and I'm one of the first people, I think, to say this. No one's a lone wolf anymore with the Internet. You have support groups out there, whether tacitly or directly or tangentially one way or the other. So no one is just fomenting these ideas in their own head and acting accordingly. The Unabomber may have truly been the last person to do that without outside external stimuli like these folks have today. So,
well, living up in his cabin in the woods up there. Yeah. The one question, and we're just about out of time. Do you see, when you're looking as a profiler, a certain type, certain tells, certain indicators that would make someone more susceptible to perpetrating this kind of hideous act?
Michael, that's therein lies the $64 million question. With inflation, we'll put it up to there. My former colleagues at the FBI did a great study a few years ago, studying a bunch of these people. And, there's certain parameters of age, there's certain parameters of race. It does tend to be majority white, 63% or so. But after that, a lot of things get mixed up and jumbled. There is some level of mental health issue involved with these people, whether it's truly diagnosable, whether it's a personality disorder, truly something, schizophrenia or psychosis. That's actually pretty rare. But are they paranoid, depressed, have anxiety? That seems to be more a factor involved. And it just has to do with people listening to the people, other people around them, family members, who is going off the chart, who's changing their behavior, who has access to weapons. If you can link all those things together, it's time to call the police or the FBI and say, hey, do me a favor, do us a favor in the community, check this guy out. That's what we need more of.
We do. And we would also love to, can we keep you on? Do you have another 10 minutes to be with us? Mr. Fitzgerald?
Well, I'll shift my schedule around for you and your listeners, Mike.
I appreciate it. We're very eager to do that. Speaking to James Fitzgerald, former FBI agent, who did an epically brilliant job, and he's done a memoir series called A Journey to the Center of the Mind. We've posted that up at our website at michaelmedved.com. We'll be right back. I want to get Mr. Fitzgerald's specific insights on the specific killers in all three of the cases now that there's a domestic terror investigation involving the Gilroy shooting as well. We'll be right back on The Medved Show. James Fitzgerald is a hero of American law enforcement, and that's not overstating it. A longtime agent and profiler and forensic linguist for the FBI. He was best known for breaking the Unabomber case, which led to the arrest of the deranged environmentalist, in quotes, murderer, Ted Kaczynski. The story of his service to our country, which is a memoir series. It is called A Journey to the Center of the Mind. Information is posted up at michaelmedved.com. Mr. Fitzgerald, I know you've been reading the press reports like everybody else. You obviously have some contacts still at the Bureau and in law enforcement and in counterterror activities. Do you buy the idea, which the press has widely reported, that none of the three killers, not the one in Gilroy, California, not the one in El Paso, Texas, not the one in Dayton, Ohio, none of them were really on any watch lists or suspected of potential terrorist activity? Does that sound credible to you?
Michael, yeah, and all I have at this point are the media reports, and I'm not talking to anybody directly involved in these investigations, so I'm the same as you and many of your listeners in that regard. But it seems like the Gilroy shooter and El Paso, very low footprint, if you will, social media, including arrest records. The Dayton guy, however, seems to have been on a number of people's radar. And it's kind of a flashback to the Parkland shooter from February of last year, who he was a few years younger, of course, but he had all kinds of interactions with police, people calling hotlines and tip lines complaining about him. And now we have this guy in Dayton who seemingly had all kinds of issues going on, including this porno grind and music scene. I got to be honest, I never heard of porno grind before yesterday and doing this research for these calls.
By the way, for people who don't know, he played apparently with a porno grind band. And I've got to, even though I try to monitor trends in the pop culture, this is one that escaped me. Porno grind shows are apparently, I don't think I can say the name of the band he was in. It's Something Munchies, and as the name of the band he was in. And they perform in a genre named either grindcore, gore grind, or porno grind. It says, the lyrics discuss oftentimes in extremely graphic and violent ways pornographic and sexual themes. I guess that's pretty much all you can say on the radio show. But aside from that, he apparently had compiled a list in high school, and the school authorities got it and they threw him out of school. A list of people, he had them side by side, is men he planned to kill and girls that he planned to rape. That's probably not a good indicator.
Well, it's not, and that's why I've said this in the last 24 hours. That's exactly sort of a tell of these people involved in the incel community. That's the involuntary celibacy, where men, usually late teens to early 30s, whatever, feel that they should have as much right as any other man to have intimate relations with attractive, quote-unquote, attractive women. And if they don't, they want to take it out on the women. They want to take it out on the men. So what does this guy do in high school? He has a list of the men he'd want to kill and the women he'd want to basically, you know, have sex with, if not rape. And, I mean, that's pretty much what incel is. There's even a term for it. There's a whole incel dictionary. And the one term that I picked up involving this guy is going ER. And the initials are of the shooter in the Isla Vista, California mass murder several years ago, in which six people were killed, numerous injured. And, of course, ER could also stand for emergency room. But perhaps that's what this guy did Saturday night, Sunday morning, whenever that actually occurred, but taking out his sister and her boyfriend at the same time. That's the oddest part of this Dayton shooting. And I'm not sure this has ever happened before in an actual mass shooting of this type, where someone took out a family member, and perhaps that was this shooter's only real goal. Remember with the D.C. sniper, and I said this in the very first days back in 2002, we can't rule out that one of those first victims, or maybe even some subsequent victims, are the actual target they want to, he or they want to kill. And it turns out John Muhammad was looking to kill his ex-wife so he could stop paying her alimony, child support, and get his couple kids back. So this whole thing in Dayton may have been, I hate my sister, I hate her boyfriend, I'm jealous of them, she's attractive, she has friends, she has a boyfriend, I don't have anything, I have this, the best I have is reliving this list from high school, take her out, oh, while I'm at it, let's shoot up and kill a bunch of other people too. So it could have been almost as simple, I hate to put it in these terms, but as simple as that in the way this guy's brain synapses connect. Obviously, Gilroy and El Paso are going to be different, but it's still a lack of the coordination of the brain synapses where you, me, and your listeners, we know how to handle and adjust and interact with these types of issues we don't always like about ourselves or others, but we don't go out and kill people. These people just don't have the coping skills to handle them as they should, as what is societally accepted.
Well, both of those two young men also appear to have been living at home. One was only 19, but the other one was 21, living with his grandparents, and also appear not to have had any kind of significant social life. The president and many others have spoken about an association with first-person shooter video games. There are now a number of psychologists and experts in the video game industry, and the New York Times said, no, there's no association at all between any of these white supremacist mass shooters, at least, and video games. Do you buy that?
You know, I mean, I haven't personally conducted research in that regard, but I mean, and exactly how it's done, what their sample size is, who they're actually talking to. I mean, if a kid is so immersed in violent video games and or even watching violent movies or TV shows, is he going to voluntarily take a, you know, participate in research like this and fill out some kind of a questionnaire? Probably not, because they don't even like the whole concept of psychologists or research, whatever. So they may be missing a large group there. But, you know, I'm not going to go on the record and say all these people look at violent criminal games. But if you're from your very earliest days, you're just being exposed to. I can't sit and watch a football game on a Sunday afternoon without a commercial coming on for a movie and there's gunplay. And I mean, and you sit with your little kids, which my kids are older now, but I have grandkids now, and I don't want them seeing the gunplay advertised during a commercial. Granted, football may be violent too, but it's a game.
Yeah, and it's a different. It's not deadly violence. It's certainly not supposed to be. And remember the Columbine shooting, which in many ways was a big milestone. Those two guys were both video game addicts, right?
They were, and they were a fan of a certain movie, and I'm drawing a blank on it now. I think Leonardo DiCaprio was in it, actually, and he played some, there was some fantasy sequence of him walking into a room with a shotgun under his trench coat, a classroom, and killing a bunch of his students. And I believe they were a big fan of that movie, or at least seen it a few times. But I'm not going to blame Hollywood, per se, but it's ironic that no one decries gun violence more than Hollywood, but no one seems to be proponents of it more than Hollywood. It's kind of interesting irony there.
There's so many ironies here. So greatly appreciate your time and your service to our country. The book by James Fitzgerald, former FBI agent and profiler, is A Journey to the Center of the Mind. And to understand how some of this all-important work of avoiding the next incident and blocking the next incident and notifying authorities about the next potential mass shooter, you can take a look at that book. Coming up, there's somebody, Princeton professor, who goes beyond blaming the president. He blames you, all of us. What's the guilt? We'll tell you about that in this greatest nation on God's green earth.